and welcome to Label Sessions Presents, the podcast where we talk to the most interesting people about all the things you need to know over the next 100 days, from innovation to business, design, tech, and culture. I am Fuzz and Iso, and today we're joined by five new label mates, all experts in their field, as well as Josh Nixon from the Label Sessions team. Hello, everyone. A quick rundown of who we're chatting to today. So we have Liza Sutherland, the investor who knows what it takes because she's been there before. Liza brings 2 decades of hands-on startup experience, founder, funder, advisor, and accelerator lead, backing outlier funders who don't fit the mold but go on to raise millions. Then we have Christina Lazic, Google products brand strategist by day, and then an Ibiza DJ by night. Christina fuses tech world precision with creative soul, building brands, platforms, and record labels that make as much sense in a boardroom as they do on a dance floor. Then hello and welcome to Dondi Dix, the turnaround operator who brings calm to chaos. Dondi leads high stakes business transformation with many sharp system thinking and people first leadership, fixing structure, stabilizing teams, and making herself redundant when the job is done. And then a big welcome to Al Bucknam, the growth strategist guiding clean energy through the messy middle. Al brings calm clarity to scaling clean energy and industrial tech companies, fixing leadership teams, broken sales engines, and strategic direction when the stakes get the highest. And then welcome to Toby Laws, the brand strategist who makes every touch point count. Toby turns sprawling customer journeys into sharp, consistent brand experiences, whether he's launching foldable tech in clean rooms or reimagining Guinness from the ground up. In recent years, we've seen ESG going from an assumption, a given, to more of a controversy in many corporate boardrooms. At the same time, the clean tech and sustainable sector continues to thrive around the world. Patagonia have celebrated the progress their trust structure has made, helping them continue their climate commitments without their founder at the head table. Many leaders we work with feel the need to play their part in driving an energy transition. But what is the best way to navigate corporate decision-making structures? And can boards be made to see a commercial opportunity in sustainable tech and in clean tech? Do we all need to create Patagonia-style trusts, or is there still a role for more of a compliance-based mindset? Al, you kind of know I'm going to come to you with this first.
Shocking. I would say, just starting with that specific example, but I'm going to expand it quite a bit, you know, Patagonia is in a somewhat unique, really for them, an ideal intersection between customer and investor alignment around their sustainability brand. And, you know, so it's great they've been able to do that. In their case, I'd say, you know, the investor, you know, private ownership has decided to take their return in environmental stewardship rather than pure economic return on capital. You know, not all companies are positioned that way. So as I've seen in, you know, clean tech, solar storage, fuel cells, et cetera, you know, there's a lot of either private equity ownership or public companies with diverse shareholders who don't have environmental philanthropy as their number one objective. And, you know, if you look at the shareholders of a public company, there's probably a spectrum of how ardent they are in their support for environmental stewardship versus other objectives that would return their investment. So I'm going to focus more on where I've been, which is in the B2B sector. So my customers have almost always been companies and or the customers of companies I work with. And almost every company I've ever dealt with is looking for the power of and, enhanced profitability and environmental stewardship. So when a company deploys solar, they're seeking both. They're looking for, I want to save money versus what I pay for the grid, or I want to have better resilience in case the grid goes down, and or I want to take a step to improve the environment with my offering because my customers and perhaps my shareholders are asking for me to focus on that. And you can achieve both. So, you know, Walmart's a great example, right? Walmart made huge strides and got a lot of attention. This is probably a couple of decades ago in removing packaging waste from their supply chain. And they, in doing so, they reduced a lot of waste and a lot of, you know, things going to landfills, but they also reduce their cost and increase their profitability. When they were considering fuel cells back in my fuel cell days, they were looking at it as clean, clean technology, but also a way to have constant voltage on their material handling equipment in their strategic distribution centers, where they are always looking to improve the return on that investment. And they saw fuel cells as a way to do that. So I'd say most companies, I mean, again, if I think back of my large customers, IKEA is the only customer I can recall that was just putting solar on every rooftop they had, even if it didn't make sense in that market. But I believe on a portfolio basis, they probably still did well economically, in addition to demonstrating that stewardship to their customer base. So I'll pause there. But that's
so basically, IKEA put solar panels up on the UK stores, is what I'm hearing.
I don't know. I mean, it's certainly in the U.S. Across all their stores, and they're definitely, when they did it, they were paying more for their electricity from that source, because this could go back to 15, 20 years ago. They were definitely paying more for the electricity as a result in a given store, in a given location, like in the Midwest. Now, in states that had incentives and good solar resource, they might have been saving money versus their energy bill, like in California. So depends on where they are. But again, overall, I think they probably did well from a combination of economics and their brand image that their customers believe is important.
How, in your opinion, though, how well do you think that they communicated that net message? So it's one thing to say that they lost money on this store or that store, but if it really was a net gain, and that's ultimately what they're being held accountable to their customer base, to say, hey, we moved the needle here on energy. To what extent do you really think that got back out to the consumers that actually care so much about what they're trying to do?
I can't really say how, because again, I'm not on that end of things in terms of looking at, how their customer base perceives them. But I've always thought of IKEA as a store that kind of, markets that as part of their corporate identity. So I do think it is in keeping with who they were. That's another important thing, right? Who are you as a company? What's your persona as a company, which is part of your brand and part of your customer experience and part of why shareholders invest in you? So again, you need to put all those pieces together. You're not usually going to be fortunate enough to have a customer base and a shareholder group that are in lockstep around a specific non-economic objective. So you have to balance it all. And again, go back to find a way to embrace the power of and by putting some things together that make sense on both fronts.
And please forgive the leading question, because I'm not picking on IKEA. I mean, I'm not picking on IKEA by any means. I was struck by the fact that I think, Generation Z and Generation Alpha coming up right behind them in particular. We all care, but they seem to have a bit more of that bent to saying, well, that's fine, but you have to show me, you have to be accountable to me. Because we're talking about energy in ESG, but the S of ESG as well, the social impact. I think we've all seen some pretty extraordinary examples lately where people are they're showing what they care about in terms of social responsibility based on their wallets, and I think that that's only going to continue.
Well, I have a couple of examples of some programs on which I work when I was at Google. I was in the brand and reputation marketing team, so I was leading programs that were aiming to improve the reputation of Google, not only with consumers, but also with institutions. So an example that I can give is the Grow with Google program, which is a program that is basically helping, at least for Italy, small and medium enterprises digitize with free trainings on digital skills. And we're talking about Italy, which is a market where a lot of small and medium enterprises don't even have a website, to make you understand how digitized, yes, Italy is. But this kind of programs, and as well as other programs like one called Be Internet Awesome, helping basically Google is going to schools to teach about being safe online and how to learn the basics of how to spot misinformation, how to build a strong password. So these kind of programs are helping Google to really gain the love from consumers, so whether they are small and medium enterprises owners or whether they are students. So in this way, you're kind of, you know, positioning the brand in a way that is really loved by the ultimate customer. But at the same time, the value that the company gets is also institutional, because of course, all of these programs are kind of, you know, told to ministries and institutional, you know, people. And it's positioning the brand well on both perspectives. And I think that it's a very, you know, good and winning strategy, because it does well for the company. Ultimately, maybe you don't sell products, but you are improving the reputation with a good return from, you know, also economic perspective, because of course, you are gaining also economic power if you are dealing with institutions. But at the same time, you're really helping users. You know, you're really, really helping companies grow. You're really helping students get safe online. So I think it's a winning approach.
I'd also be remiss if I didn't point out, because it gets lost, you know, particularly in some parts of the U.S. or I'm looking at Toby and the snowstorm in the U.K. You know, the it's important to know that in a place like the Gulf region, where there is like just constant abundant sunshine, and there's no like real barriers, there's no tariffs on solar panels, labor costs are on the lower side compared to the US or the UK. And there, if you deploy solar on a commercial rooftop, parking lot, whatever, or even remotely and you know, wield the power to that customer, they're getting a discount to what they pay for grid electricity of 20 to 40% sometimes. And the company that's providing that is making a good return that, you know, private equity investors like, and there's no incentives. So, you know, there's a bit of a myth out there that, oh, you can only have solar if you have, you know, ridiculous incentives and you're just paying to keep this weak technology alive. No, it makes economic sense in some markets, and that's building volume, which is going to keep driving cost out. And, you know, in a place like the U.S., one of our bigger challenges is just getting frictional costs out of the system, because we have 50 states, way more than 50 utility territories, and a whole bunch of municipalities that can each determine their own solar policy. Hey, we're having a moratorium on new development of solar here in our town, and then the next one over loves it. So you're having to navigate all these different jurisdictions, and there's a huge cost to that. So finding a way to streamline just permitting and approvals is one way that, you know, some higher cost markets will get there. So it is going in the right direction, and it is economically feasible, unsubsidized. So just to throw that in there.
There are definitely VC funds that specialize in this area and who will put great amounts of money into there. That's been going on for a long time. And that's not going away because we all need it. It's an area of growth, but it you know, it is for specialists who understand and can help drive that forward. As far as really early stage companies integrating it or using it, that's not their priority. They just need to get their product going with this little bit of money and hopefully get that next round going or a customer. I have met founders of companies who've created ESG software for VC funds portfolio, and I would highly recommend they stop doing that. it's just not what their priority should be, and I don't know how they're doing that, but